familiar faces and some new faces. So welcome everybody to the recording. I'm very happy to be recorded and hopefully split into YouTube shorts and reels and everything else too. It's all good. My name is Chuck Marone. I am an engineer and a planner and the president of an organization called Strong Habits. We've been engaged here in Lake County for the entirety of this year, having a conversation about how we build stronger cities, how we build stronger towns, how we build stronger county. We have done a big kickoff event in January where we spent a whole day meeting with a bunch of people and then did some evening presentations. And after that, we started with online meeting with an action team, a group of people here that we've been training on Strong Towns ideas, Strong Towns concepts. At the same time, we had a public engagement going on online. We were producing content and lessons for people. We were sharing information on social media. We were actually paying for advertising and targeting to get the message out in the area. That all built up to, I want to say it was June when we came back. We had another series of events in June. Those were more focused on housing and housing-related stuff. We talked about a bunch of other things. Again, meeting in the north side of the county, the south side of the county. We've continued the online engagement since then. We've had millions of interactions, hundreds of thousands of different accounts that have accessed us on different social media sites in the targeted Lake County area. Since we started this, there's a lot of conversation going on shallow and a lot of conversation going on deep in places. This is our third event, and this event kind of marks not the end of the project, but the end of this more intensive engagement. We've still got a little bit of work to do with the action team, and then we're going to switch into kind of a support mode from here on out. The public site that we've created is going to be available indefinitely. We don't have any plans to take it down. Obviously, it's free for anybody to access, free for anybody to use. We've been sharing information along this whole time, kind of a story of Lake County. I hope that story becomes outdated in time. but as of today, it's very applicable to where you're at and some of the things you're struggling with. And if you're signed up on the email list, you've had access to that and get notices on that. And we'll let you know when we've updated it and that kind of thing. If you're not signed up, my card's in the back, Edward's card's in the back. Grab one of those, email us, and you can do that. Or talk to one of us afterwards and we'll be able to connect you to that. That's going to be up indefinitely. And our hope is that as new projects come up, as new conversations take place, as new people enter into your life and your conversation, as things trip your mind, you don't have to be a lone warrior. You can say, hey, here's some stuff from Strong Towns that was done specifically for Lake County that you can access and you can share it there. And, bring people up to speed with where you're at. Tonight we're going to talk about transportation. And before we get started, let me just pause and see if there's any kind of upfront questions or any upfront things you want to talk about. You got something? Give me one.
Transportation is that in this county, you're getting overwhelmed with traffic. I live across the highway out here.
That's an interesting observation.
To get here because the traffic is so bad out there.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem is that all the cities, and I've been to all 14 cities, they keep approving high density development outside of the city. They annex it in, and then they don't improve the roads or the infrastructure. I mean, I've actually been to like Leesburg where city managers say, well, we don't bother with the roads. We leave that to the city and to the county, the county and the state. We think it's their responsibility. But then they go and they'll build 2,000 homes out there and no work to reduce the traffic.
Hear you. Hold that. That was more of a comment question. But I get what you're saying. Hold on to that because I think that's what we're going to talk about here. Anything on the process, like up to this point, before we dig deep in the transportation over the next 4 hours?
No. You could ask that question here at the end.
Let's talk about that question. If you don't feel that I have addressed that question, at the end, let's talk about it. Is this yours? Oh, okay, good. I was like, someone... Oh, that's yours. Good.
I mean, just a general overall strong bounce question.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. Oh, all right, so it's a year later.
We're getting close, yeah.
We were essentially part of the first class, right?
Yes, this is the first time we've done the Community Action Lab program. There's four different cities, or four different places that are going through this. One county, three cities.
Yeah. So given that,
yeah.
What do you think you have, as an organization, maybe even as individuals, that's up to you.
Yeah.
What have you learned and or what would you do differently so that we can get the maximum out of this going forward? I mean, I want us to be kind of like the virgin failed experiment. I want us to be the...
Oh, yeah. That's a really good question. And we've had a lot of discussion about this. We're actually having we get our whole team together. We all work remotely. There's 23 of us that will come here to Orlando the first week of next month, and that's one of our agenda items. I can give you my thoughts, which are my thoughts, and maybe you have something to add to that. I always focus on what we can do better. There's a whole list of things I think that have gone very well. We reach a lot of people. We can tell that the conversation is different today than it was 11 months ago. The things that are being reflected back to us that we're picking up we've got some pretty sophisticated media monitoring, like conversation monitoring things, and the things that we're seeing in there have our language in them in a way that they didn't before. So we're seeing the ideas being disseminated. They're not always like attributed to us, but people are talking about things in ways that we, okay, that's good. Like, we're starting to see that. We're seeing that particularly in some of the cities, where some of the conversations in the municipal governments are now including things about financial performance, financial productivity, public return on investment, in a way that we were not seeing a year ago. And, you know, we've been one seed in that conversation, but hopefully we've been an accelerator of where the other seeds have been planted by others as well. For us, I think the main, there's two challenges. One is specific to Lake County and one is organizational. A big part of our approach as a movement, as a thought experiment, as a nonprofit, is based around shifting the culture. There's a lot of organizations that are for-profit and non-profit that do consulting and coaching and training and give advice. What we do is we're trying to broadly shift the conversation. The idea of trying to do that in a place as opposed to just more generally was the biggest challenge for us. And our hope throughout this project was that we would be able to tell a lot of stories about Lake County and tell stories about Medicine Hat, tell stories about Norman, and tell stories about Chisholm, the other places we're working in, as we went along. And what we found is that that just was not possible. It was not possible for a bunch of reasons, but the main like cultural one is that when you're working intimately with people on a very hard set of challenges and problems, if you start writing stories about them, pointing out, here's a struggle, here's how it was addressed, all of that stuff, it changes the way people work with you. Is this gonna wind up on a website that 20,000 people are gonna see? Are you gonna write about, you know, this interaction in one way or the other? Is this gonna look unfavorable on us? And so I found us at a number of points where we were kind of eager to write about things, or eager to talk about things. Moving those things over onto the Academy site, where it would be more targeted, more limited, it was good for the conversation here, but my board of directors wants to see us, how do I put this, they're not satisfied if we go in and work with one community, and even if we have a great impact there, they want us to be broadly changing things. And so the only way that this works for us as a long-term project you know, new cities coming on and all that, is if we can take good things that happen here, hold them up as an example for other communities in similar situations to learn from and inspire dozens of other places to do things. That's our model for change. And I'm a little frustrated that we weren't able to deliver on that more. Part of our conversation in December is going to be about how, now that we have ended the intense part of the engagement, how do we do that more in the coming years? Because we made a lot of great contacts here. We have a lot of people on the ground that we're very intimate with now. How do we tell those positive success stories? Now that we're not kind of engaged blow by blow on things. I said I had a Lake County specific thing and a general thing. That was my general thing. I can't remember off the top of my head about Lake County. Do you have something you want to add?
You
probably, go ahead.
Yeah, so this is a community
action. I remember what I wanted to talk about.
This is a community action lab. You all invited us in as a laboratory, to look at Lake County as a laboratory. And I talk to my team every week. Every other week, we are on the phone call with your action team members. It's the largest of our action teams.
What is your team?
What?
What is your team?
Our Strong Towns team, we are coaching. There's 26 members on a community action lab action team here in the county. It represents across the spectrum of your 14 municipalities. There are people that are working in government. There are people that are active in your community. Because Lake County is not only long, it's also our largest, we have this large team of folks where they're providing feedback every other week. We gave them homework assignments. When I talk to our team and our board, there are things that are happening in Lake County that are really, really good that you don't all take credit for.
Mm-hmm.
And part of those sessions are identifying it. Like one of the things in Groveland, there's incredible stuff happening in Groveland that over in Claremont, they don't even know is happening. We published an incredible story about work that their planning department and economic development is doing on pre-approved building plans. People across the country are doing this. We published it. I get more calls from people in Lake County wanting to know more about that than anywhere else in the country. For us, that was a level of success. And tomorrow, we're going to be having a session on housing and talking about that as a we talk about struggles and responses. There's a struggle in Lake County related to housing. This is a response. We're going to talk about that. There are little embers that are happening here. We also, in Lake County through this is a journey. If you think about this as a course, we talked a lot about the action team giving them homework, putting assignments out there. Shortly after we created the academy for that core group, the leadership team, your elected officials in Lake County of the different municipalities and the county government said, can we share this publicly? And we created this public site that hundreds of people have signed up for. Every 2 to 3 weeks, we put new information up. There's 10 different sessions there that go through different issues that relate to Lake County with examples from Lake County. That is up and out for the public. What I found really interesting with this is it took time to work through each of these principles. Back in January, when we first came here, Chuck went through and did a presentation. We did three. One was a six-hour session, but it was a lot of developers. And then we had two sessions with the public. There were 8 or 9 incredible ideas that we shared that people could relate to, but didn't quite understand what we were talking about. And the beauty of the Community Action Lab is that we've had the opportunity for the year to dive into those and talk about, and have people in Lake County talk to us about those issues in Lake County. So that kind of education, get everybody on the same level, is what we have been seen through here. And now our phones are starting to ring because people are asking questions. We have municipalities, we have city managers, planning directors, elected officials calling and saying, I was introduced to this concept through the Community Action Lab. A Community Action team member talked to me about this thing. This is really similar to a struggle we have in town. How does this apply?
Well, this was the thing that I wanted to bring up. I guess the one challenge I wanted to bring up.
and then maybe we should move on then. But let me say, Lake County is the only place where our action team was non-technical. Is that fair?
Yes.
Yeah. And by that I mean, okay, in any community, with the work that we're doing about growth and development, public investment, there's three kind of locuses of power. There is the elected officials who make decisions and lead the community. There is the technical staff, the people who work for the city. Sometimes they're consultants and work adjacent to the city or the county. They're technical people. And then there's third is just the broad, massive culture in the community. People who are involved, people who are invested, people who vote, who own land, who live here. It's the broad community. We have as our theory of change that in order for things to move, you have to have two of those three in alignment. A really good council and a really good staff can bring along the public. Public that wants to see change and an elected body that wants to see change can ultimately change the staff and influence the direction we go. That kind of thing. In every community that we work with the Action Lab, our action team, the team that we're coaching and training, has been the technical people inside government. And I'm going to say something, and I know you're recording me. Don't snip this little bit because it will be out of context. What we find is of those three kind of locuses of change, the hardest one to influence is the staff. It's the technical staff. They're always the ones at the heart because they have, often they work in silos, they work in hierarchies, they have professional things they do, they show up at 8, they leave at 5, they've got certain things they do each day. And part of what we're doing is moving that, like shifting that. And so I'm going to be interested to see, I like the conversation here, I like the dialogue here, but it has largely been outside of the technical people. And I think it's going to be very interesting to see long term how this one fares compared to some of the other places that we've worked. And so the other communities we've worked, we've seen local conversations spring up and other things that are more kind of involved with the public. But we've also had this deep, intimate conversation with the technical people. So there's a merging there. And we have it. That has not, we opted to go in a different direction here, and I'm not lamenting that. It's just different, and I'm kind of curious to see how it works out. Does that make sense?
It makes perfect sense, and I want to say to you guys, I saw that change.
Yeah.
You didn't come in here in January and say, this is what we're going to do, and just plow forward and just blindly do it. You've modified your approaches, modified message, and modified some of the delivery of the message. So it was not intended to be a thing, but.
Thank you. No, I appreciate that. There's a lot of introspection that goes on in these things for us too. I want to keep moving, but go ahead.
I want to let you know that I believe from your, in January,
yeah.
When you came and you did whole discussion on brownfields.
Yeah.
I think that finally got Groveland to welcome that.
Thank you.
Because they fought it years ago.
Yeah.
And now they seem to be very open to it.
Yeah, we've seen, I'm glad you say that. I always want to, if we go from 1 to 6, I want to go from 1 to 8. Like that's always, kind of our internal mindset. I have, if I sit back and I look at it, I have seen that kind of thing happen too. Groveland is a special place, and there's been some significant, I think, movement there that this conversation has allowed to happen. Yeah. There's a lot of support for those things too, and I think having it bubble up the way it has been helpful. You had something, and then I'm going
to. Yes, I just wanted to know if you're seeing how this is being implicated into the new GPAs,
JPAs.
Those are the growth development boundaries?
The joint planning agreements.
Oh, joint planning agreements.
Can you repeat what the comment was?
How this, if this work is influencing those, the joint
planning
agreements? Well, I can tell you it's come up every single time we've met with folks. It's come up every single time, because I know it's something active in the community. So it has come up, and what I appreciate with it is that the conversations we're having, that people are sharing comments we have shared through Strong Towns. So there's, it's influencing those discussions at council meetings and the general public and everyone's staff.
Okay. Let's talk transportation. And then I will go through this. I was going to say, quick. I will go through this at not a leisurely pace. Sometimes when I get going, if I feel very comfortable, which I do here, I tend to slow down. And it's more fun sometimes. But we'll get to questions here.
Can you use the mic?
Oh, I'm sorry. You want me to use the microphone?
Yes.
Let me see.
Yes, please.
I'll respect that request.
Thank you.
Well, it's kind of my vibe is to wander around a little bit, right?
Never knows.
No, you didn't? Now you're being cheeky. Is that better?
Yes.
Okay. I feel a little bit neutered back here, but I will do this for you. I can drop the thing and use both hands this way. When it comes to transportation, we have all these things that we really want to do, right? We need to fix our infrastructure. We've got congestion problems we have heard about. We want to make safety improvements. We've got to respond to future growth. And when it comes to these things we want to do, we just don't have enough money. We've got all these demands on our system, right? We have this group of people, retirees, who I think a couple decades ago wanted something, and today they want something very different. We've got this very strange group of young people that are trying to figure out where they fit in all this. We want to respond to these demands, right? We want to meet these things that we're being asked to do, but we don't have enough money. We're getting pushed to do all these things. And while I get that you're not maybe getting rail investments out here, you certainly have push for some transit, some bike lanes, some pedestrian improvements. These things are all things that people are asking for. We just don't have enough money to do them all. The obvious answer is what? We just need more. We just need more money. If you step back and look at the transportation conversation in this country, it is primarily a conversation about how we get more money to do the things that we're doing today. Where is that money going to come from? How do we get the money? If you go to the county and ask them to go through their road plans for the future, they all include deep assumptions about there being more money and more resources than what is currently available or currently projected. I want to give you some perspective on that, because that, the idea that there will be more money to do this, is probably the biggest delusion that we have driving bad land use decisions locally. The American Society of Civil Engineers put out a report that said nationally, so across the nation, we have a $94 billion a year gap in basic maintenance of our roadways. Now, this is just federally funded roadways. This doesn't include state roads, county roads, local streets. This is just federally funded infrastructure, $94 billion a year. I wanted to give you some context for that. The federal gas tax is 18.4 cents a gallon, right? There is some push to adjust that to inflation. This came before the recent inflation, so when inflation was really low. The idea is let's catch it up and make it current based on, because this was 18.4 was put in place like in 93 or 94. If we brought it up to date with inflation, it would be about 29.7 cents a gallon. And the idea is if we did this, this would give us more money to fund transportation, right? If we adjusted it for GDP growth, or was how fast is the economy growing, we'd have a gas tax. Instead of federal gas tax of 18.4, we'd have one about 30 cents a gallon. I also said, how interesting would it be if we adjusted it for growth in traffic, right? That would get us to about 24 cents a gallon. But if we actually adjusted the federal gas tax to what we needed to raise the money just to maintain, not build anything new, but just maintain the federal transportation infrastructure we already have, that would be a gas tax of about 78 cents a gallon. Now, here's the interesting thing about that. That assumes a static response, right? We all understand that these things are dynamic. The more you raise the gas tax, the less people drive. The more you have to raise it to get the same amount of money, the less people drive. I saw once where a group out of Wisconsin did this dynamically, and they ended up with an infinite gas tax where nobody drove, because the money actually never paid for itself over the long term. That same report, the American Society of Civil Engineers said, if we do not go out and maintain our infrastructure, it is going to cost families and businesses over the next decade $1 trillion in losses. That's $1 trillion of losses in time spent in traffic and extra wear and tear on your vehicles. In order to avoid that that loss, the American Society of Civil Engineers in this report recommended that we spend $220 trillion over the next decade. Go ahead, you can, it sounds absurd. This is actually what they recommended. They looked out over the next 3 decades and they said, if we don't invest in transportation properly, the gross domestic product, the economy, is going to grow less than it otherwise would. And that depressed growth is going to mean we're going to actually collect less federal taxes than we otherwise would. They estimate that that loss in federal revenue would be $540 billion over the next 3 decades. In order to avoid that $540 billion loss, they recommend spending $6.6 trillion on transportation. Now, these numbers feel insane, right? They feel crazy. In fact, as I presented this in the past, I've gotten to this point and I've had people say, well, Chuck, you lack credibility now with us because these numbers don't seem like they're very real. I want to show you how the American Society of Civil Engineers and really highway officials everywhere arrive at these kind of conclusions. This is Highway 91 in California, one of the most congested roadways in North America. This road was recently widened. The idea was to widen it in order to address the congestion out there. Here's how this was reported in the local newspaper. The project will give some relief to drivers in the regular lanes, raising their average rush hour speeds from 8 miles an hour to 9.4 miles an hour.
Oh my God.
I want to say it was $2 billion. This is a massive, massive, massively expensive project. But understand how engineers look at this. Understand how the American Society of Civil Engineers look at this. Understand how highway officials across the country, including ones that are working on this issue in your community, look at this. They would say going from 9.4 to 8 miles an hour will save the average driver maybe 20, 30 seconds worth of time. Okay, 30 seconds multiplied by 300,000 vehicles who drive this every day, multiplied by 365 days a year, multiplied by $25 an hour, which is the typical salary and wage of a South Californian, multiplied by the 50 years that we have these extra lanes to be in place, and all of a sudden this $2 billion project is saving you $4, $5, $6 billion in lost time. Thank you for laughing. That is silly, isn't it? But that is the economics that's being put into place here. You're going to have to wait till the end, friend. If the takeaway is that this is a crazy, insane system, that is the correct takeaway. That's what I want you to walk away with tonight. The way we fund transportation and the way we think about the return on it is actually very, very divorced from reality. So this idea that we need more money is kind of the central obsession, because there is not enough money to actually make the system work the way we run it today. And so we put forward this alternate question. If we don't have the money, what do we do then? If we can't get the funds and the resources to do all the transportation stuff that we want to do, what is our response? 2 years ago? 3 years ago? Biden administration. The Biden administration came up with what they called the American Jobs Plan. This ultimately was the inflation something. I can't remember what. Everybody knows what it is. I never learned it. I can't remember. It was the infrastructure bill. But this is the proposal that the administration put forth. I'm gonna say something here because I don't want to be perceived as partisan. This is very similar to the proposal that the prior administration put up too. So I'm using their real numbers from the Biden administration. You can go back to the Trump administration. It was very similar approach. If you read the American Jobs Plan, at the very beginning, it says this is an historic public investment in our nation's productivity and long-term growth. On the very first page of the plan, it says 1 in 5 miles, 173,000 total miles, of our highways and major roads are in poor condition. And 45,000 of our bridges are in poor condition. It's the American Jobs Plan, page 1. If you then turn the page and start to read the American Jobs Plan, the administration says that this proposal will modernize 20,000 miles of highways, and it will fix 10 of the most economically significant bridges and repair 10,000 smaller bridges. So let's go back. 173,000 miles of road, 45,000 bridges, 20,000 fixed, 10,000 small. Here's how this looks like in a graph. Here's the miles of road in poor condition. Here's the miles of road that we are asking for money to maintain. Here's the number of bridges in poor condition, and here's the number of bridges that this plan would provide. Now, if you listen to the dialogue around this plan, the thing that you got from both political parties was that this infrastructure plan was huge. It was the largest infrastructure plan ever proposed. It was the largest infrastructure plan ever conceived. Democrats, which were very, you know, it's their administration, they're very proposed, said this is very, very bold, it's very visionary, it's a serious commitment to maintaining infrastructure. That it is not. Republicans, on the other hand, said this is way too big, way too bloated, way too much spending, bizarre amounts of spending, we need to cut this thing back. Not even a fraction of what is needed to take care of the stuff we have already built. Of course, the plan went through Congress. It ultimately was approved. It was approved at a much, much lower rate than this. And subsequent to that, what have we seen the money be spent on? Building new highways. Very, very little of this money. In fact, I've seen estimates of 20%, 25% have actually gone to maintaining the stuff that needed to be maintained. Most of the money has gone to building new lanes, expansion, building new interchanges, building new bridges. I bring this up, and this conversation, I want to localize it a little bit here. I'm going to ask Ed to come up and chat, because you know the actual numbers. But one of the things that is most challenging about Lake County is that you are at kind of the edge of the highway building. It's your time in the sun in terms of building auto infrastructure. You are transformed over the last couple decades from sleepy place on the very edge with modest amounts of traffic to now, as was stated earlier, so much congestion we have a hard time getting to this meeting. You've now kind of evolved into a place where people commute to and from, and that has raised a lot of related issues. Could you just talk briefly about the numbers here in terms of like the backlog and all that that we see today?
Yeah, so we looked to the action team at the county's budget. And this is a story that probably rolls down to all of the 14 municipalities in Lake County because they're all following the same model. In the budget, you're very proud of doing $2 million of roadway work in the county for maintenance. So $2 million is set aside. Recently, there was a sales tax that was dedicated for $10 million worth of roadway work. That's what's shown in the budget. It's also shown in the budget all of these projects, new roads, that the county is funding and building in Lake County, growing the inventory. When we talk about transparent local accounting, we started to look with the action team of what are the other things? What's not in the budget? Because all of you will tell me there are potholes, there are drainage issues, there's maintenance issues in Lake County, and there's not enough money to do it. Even the $10 million that was put forward wasn't enough. Well, when you talk to the folks that actually have to fill the potholes that are on the trucks, they have a website on the county's webpage. They tell us how many road miles the county is responsible for, and they use words. They tell us that if they have as many road miles that you could drive from Tavares to Boston, Massachusetts. When you draw the picture, it's a little more impactful. We went, and then it even shows within the website what it is costing to maintain roads in Lake County. Again, these are the people that take it out to bid. They're filling the potholes. They've got it on their website. If you take the roads and assume they have a 25 or 30 year life, there's $18 million worth of roadway maintenance that's required today in Lake County.
Each year.
Each year.
Yeah.
Each year, $18 million each year over.
And to reiterate, you're spending
two. You're $16 million short in what you are doing in maintenance of existing roadways. And again, this is looking at numbers that are static. That you're adding no new inventory, that there's no incidences on the road where a water pipe broke. You're short in these pieces. This is not what's in the budget. It's hard for elected officials to make decisions because the decisions they're actually putting in the budget is way more than $2 million in new additional roads in the county. If we were to show you the graphs to say that there were $18 million short, the idea of transparent local accounting is that we would make different decisions. We wouldn't be expanding beyond what our promises were. So these are some of the numbers that we found fascinating here in Lake County, and you're not alone in that. Every one of our action teams is the same. You may be a little bit better because you're younger in your road section, but this is consistent.
Right. Thanks, Frank. Yeah, it is. As cities, when Edward talks about transparent local accounting, it's one of our priority campaigns. we're not talking about cities that or counties that are trying to hide information. We're talking about government accounting that actually does not reveal these liabilities. For those of you that are familiar with accounting in the private sector, when we make a promise, even as a nonprofit, when we make a promise that we will pay something in the future, we record that on our balance sheet. That is a liability for the future. If I say that we're going to, at Strong Towns, pay a certain amount of vacation to all of our employees, and we get to the end of the year and they haven't taken their vacation, we actually have to do this accounting thing where we account for that going into the next year, that this is a liability that we owe, right? Very, very specific accounting rules. Cities do not operate in this way. When a city or a county takes on a new roadway, and that new roadway has maintenance along with it, we got to go out and do this in 5 years, and this in 10 years, this in 25 years, that doesn't show up anywhere at all. It's nowhere on the balance sheet. It's nowhere in the report. In fact, the opposite actually occurs. It shows up as an asset that the community has, that they can literally borrow against. So the more roads we build, the richer our balance sheet looks, and the more we are kind of led to believe that we are very rich, when in fact we are really, really, really poor. Again, this is not you. This is all of North America. This is every city. You are just at a particular inflection point where you are being asked to invest a lot, a lot, a lot in new infrastructure, in new building. I want to step back and walk you through a transportation engineer's vision or view of what transportation systems look like. Because we still have this problem, right? That we have congestion, we have the need to maintain roads, we have these problems. They don't go away just because we don't have the money. I want you to understand the problem a little bit more deeply so that we can ask more sophisticated questions. So this is like a kid's diagram of a transportation network, right? You have local streets that go flow into collector streets flow into arterials, arterials flow into major arterials. We all understand how this works, right? Little goes into big, goes into bigger, goes into biggest. I want you to think of a watershed. And I realize Florida is a very flat place, and watersheds maybe don't work here like they do, say, in the Rockies. I'm from Minnesota, also very flat, but I think you get the point here, right? When it rains, water flows into ditches, flows into creeks and the brooks and the streams, comes together into rivers. The rivers congeal together to form major tributaries, on and on and on, right? We all kind of understand intuitively how a watershed works. And we recognize that if you get rain within a watershed, if that rain is persistent enough, or if that rain is intense enough, what you end up with at the confluence is a flood, right? That's what happens. This is something that engineers, myself, are taught in Hydrology 101. In fact, we spent about 5 minutes on it in Hydrology 101 because it's such an obvious concept and everybody understands it. We don't have to spend a lot of time on it. Yet somehow, when we get done with Hydrology 101 and we walk across the hall to Traffic 101, this concept becomes completely elusive to us. Because if you take the same type of thing and instead of water, you just look at it in terms of asphalt and concrete, we recognize that if we get a little bit of stuff happening out here on the edge, that everything comes together to create a flood. We literally design our systems to flood. If we were to step back and say, how do we create a transportation system that induces the greatest amount of congestion possible every day, this is what it would look like. We would take everybody on the road, put them out on the same time, funnel them to the same exact place. And this is why traffic congestion is a ubiquitous experience across North America. Every community has traffic congestion. Every single one. Lake County has traffic congestion. Orlando, traffic congestion. Atlanta, Los Angeles, Chicago, traffic congestion. My little hometown of Brainerd, Minnesota, 14,000 people. If you went out at 7:50 in the morning and talked to the person sitting at the red light and said, what's traffic like? They would say, oh, it's unbearable levels of traffic congestion, right? And 15 minutes later, there would be no cars anywhere. We all have experience with traffic congestion because our system is designed to create it. As a result of this, engineers, in their prudence, react by doing forecasts. And we project out how much traffic there's actually going to be. There's been this very interesting phenomena over the last couple of decades of traffic engineers in their kind of conservative nature, projecting traffic out in ways that is not ultimately realized. My friend with the camera, I will actually give you all my slides if you would like them. I can send them to you so you can record whatever you want, but I'll give them to you so you can splice in or whatever you want. What you see here is traffic projections from Washington State for a highway that was being built. The black line is what actually happened. The colored lines are the ones that where the engineers sat and projected. Here's what we think traffic is going to do in 1996. Here's what we think it's going to do in 2000. Here's what we think it's going to do, and here's what it's actually done. Here's what this looks like nationally when you aggregate all of the state DOTs up. The interesting thing about traffic projections is that we have, as professionals, kind of a enticement to overestimate and over-design, over-engineer. And I want you to think about this from a human standpoint, right? If you are a driver and the traffic engineer has delivered for you a roadway that is oversized, over-capacity, over-engineered, what is your experience as a driver? Your experience is free flow conditions. Are you likely to call and complain? Are you likely to seek out your elected official and file some formal complaint? Are you likely to gripe about it on social media? No, you have free flow conditions. You're not sensitive to, because you don't pay directly to drive on that road, you're not sensitive to the hundreds of thousands and millions of dollars or what have you of over-engineering. Because you have free flow conditions. The user experience is very good. Imagine, on the other hand, that the engineer underdesigns by 5%. What happens if they underdesign by 5%? For parts of the day, you're gonna have congestion. Stop and go, you're gonna be stuck in traffic. Are you gonna complain then? Are you going to show up at council meetings? Are you going to lodge a complaint? Are you going to bitch on social media? Are you going to... Right, right. So for the designer, there is very limited cost for over-designing and over-engineering and over-building. But there's tremendous cost for under-designing and under-engineering. So what we do is we tend to err on the one side. You have this very unique situation here in Lake County because of where you are in the development cycle, where you have phantom homes driving phantom highway construction, driving phantom home building. It's really, really fascinating. You call it entitlements, where someone has projected on a swamp somewhere where you could probably only get 1,000 homes, that someday we're going to have 10,000 homes. And then we go out and we build the highway capacity for 10,000 homes because, Lord help us, if we underbuilt and underdesigned. And it fuels this cycle then where you have all this excess capacity, and then up the road we're going to project another 10,000 homes and another 10,000 over here and 4,000 over here. The cycle of building is driven off of the cycle of building in this kind of self-reinforcing way. I want you to take away one point from this, and that is that our propensity to over-design and over-engineer has very little consequence except for the long-term cost effect. Except for the long-term cost effect. This creates this situation for us where during rush hour, we have systems that are overwhelmed, are flooded, right? But during all other parts of the day, there's very minimal traffic. If you go out and look around, for most of the day, everything here is over-designed, over-engineered. I want to use this analogy with you because I want you to think about this a little bit differently. Imagine if the airlines sized their fleets for the amount of demand they had on Thanksgiving and Christmas, and then the rest of the year ran empty planes. This is what we do as traffic engineers. We design for the peak 15 minutes, and everything else is vastly over-engineered, vastly greater capacity, vastly over-utilized. This is not something that anybody in the private sector would ever do. You combine this with the idea of forgiving design, and you end up with this kind of self-reinforcing downward cycle. Forgiving design is this term that I was taught as a young engineer. I've spoken to young engineers today. I'm no younger one. I've spoken to them. They've never heard of forgiving design. This is just called design now today. The forgiving has been lost. But the forgiving is a very important part of the concept. And I suspect that I was taught it because it was my professors and people in their age group that came up with the forgiving idea. I was taught it as forgiving design. I suspect that people my age are just teaching it as the way things are done. The idea of forgiving design is that engineers could step back and recognize the common mistakes that drivers make, and then as part of the design, forgive that mistake, so that that mistake did not end up in a crash, a fatality, a traumatic injury. Let me walk you through what this looks like. Let's say we have two vehicles going in opposite directions. We recognize that the driver will sometimes float a little bit in their lane. They'll float a little bit too far to the left, too far to the right. We want to make sure that if they float in the lane, they look down to turn the radio station. They, you know, doze a little bit, whatever it is. We want to make sure that they don't cross over that center line and hit an oncoming vehicle. So what we do is we give them a little bit wider lanes. We give them a little bit more room to move, right? We forgive that mistake. We recognize now that drivers sometimes, in all earnestness, will go off the side of the road. They'll actually, for whatever reason, drift off to the side. We don't want them to actually go off the road because that has dramatic impacts if you slip over the lip of the edge of the road. And so what we do is we give a little bit of recovery area on the side. We widen out that side and give them a little bit of room to maneuver over there. Then we recognize that drivers sometimes lose control of their vehicle entirely. They exit the roadway, often at very, very high speeds. What we want is we want all that kinetic energy to dissipate before they run into something that won't give. And so what we do is we clear out the objects in the clear zone. We create this area on the side that's free of immovable objects. And now we have a forgiving design road. You're shaking your head. This is a standard design approach. And I'm going to say, this approach has saved millions and millions and millions of lives. It really has. It is the gold standard around the world. And when we're talking about the design of interstates, we're talking about the design of open roads, this is exactly the mentality we should be using. There's a fundamental problem with this approach, and it gets to this over-design, over-building issue. When we are on the open road, this is the approach we want to take. When we get into cities, when we get into urban areas, when we get into areas with more complexity, more turning traffic, more stopping traffic, more stop-and-go traffic, any place where we have a traffic signal, you know, anything like that, what happens is that forgiving design signals to the driver, we've given you lots of room to move. We've given you lots of room to maneuver. We've essentially forgiven your mistakes. And drivers respond to that by going faster. Yeah, they speed up. Because drivers are human. Drivers respond to the conditions that we create for them. It is a fascinating thing that I think most engineers don't think about, and most non-engineers don't think is possible. How there is no body of practice in North America for building local streets. In fact, this is the manual on uniform traffic control devices. This is one of the Bibles of the engineering traffic engineering profession. If you go to the manual on uniform traffic control devices and you say, all right, I'm not working on a highway, I'm working on a local street. What is the difference between the two? If you look up the definition of street, it actually says, see highway. There's no discernment between the two. So the exact standards you would use to design I-4 are the same standards that you are called upon to use to design the local street out in front of your house. This is absurd. This is the world that we have created, and it's the world that transportation professionals live in. And so you wind up with this kind of conundrum where we're designing a local street to provide a safety margin. We'll design it for 60 miles an hour. In order for it to be safe for locals, we will have a 25 mile an hour speed limit. And then traffic will drive somewhere in between the two, right? We've all been on these local streets that the speed limit is very low and the thing is really wide and you feel like you should drive faster, but you really can't because the speed limit's low and you have this tension in the middle somewhere. These are ridiculously expensive things to build. They're also very, very unsafe. Very, very unsafe. What we are not recognizing is the way that humans react to our designs. There's a fantastic book called Thinking Fast and Slow by a psychologist named Daniel Kahneman. And Kahneman looks at the way the human brain processes information. We all like to think that we are thoughtful, rational people who make decisions based on pure logic. We are not. If you read Kahneman's book, I can summarize it for you. The summary would be, humans are slightly evolved chimpanzees. We tend to operate almost all the time in what he calls system one, which is intuitive, instinctual, very, very quick decision making. If I ask you what is 1 + 1, everyone in this room can say 2, and you don't have to crowd out any other information from your brain in order to answer that question. But if I asked you to add 2 4-digit numbers together, very few of us could do that without some mental processing, without crowding everything else out, visualizing the numbers, carry the one, do all that kind of thing. That more complicated thing is a system two type of activity. System two takes effort, it's slow, it drains you. My daughter just recently took the SAT test, and this is a kid who does competitive dance. So hours of aerobic activity every day. She got out of the SAT and she said, I've never been more tired in my life. Sitting, filling up ovals for 4 hours. How is that so tiring? It's tiring because you're in system two the entire time. Your brain is mentally engaged. Here's why I bring this up. Driving is and always is a system one activity. It's something we do passively without thinking about it. I know a lot of people would like to think that driving is a system two activity. When everybody gets in the car, you're driving, you have to be fully engaged. No one does that. No one is capable of doing that. The only people capable of doing that would be like a race car driver or a jet fighter pilot, right? Normal humans cannot do that. How many of you, when you're driving, feel like it's safe to talk to someone in the passenger seat? How many of you feel it's safe to listen to a song on the radio? Maybe even sing along? We feel this way because driving is a system one activity. It's one that we don't do with our brains 100% engaged. It's not like taking the SAT test. We can do other things mentally. And because we do other things mentally, because we're not 100% engaged in the activity, the system one, the instinctual, is what takes over. This leads us to this uncomfortable truth, and that is that people will tend to drive the speed they feel comfortable driving, regardless of any other factor. Whatever the roadway suggests to the driver is a safe speed to drive, that is the speed that most drivers will drive. That makes these campaigns, you know, be safe, be smart, even these that are, I think, way more offensive. Pedestrians don't come with airbags. And we're going to show you a bunch of pictures of kids getting run over to try to shame people into changing their behavior. It is a lack of recognition amongst transportation professionals of what causes speeding. What causes speeding is not reckless humans. What causes speeding is not people who don't care. You can't change people's minds by showing them an ad. The only thing that changes people's minds, the only thing that changes people's behavior, is a different design, one that actually creates some friction. So engineers have this approach to highways that works really, really well. You go out and say, are people speeding? They do a speed study. If yes, people are speeding on a highway, the proper response is to raise the speed limit. You actually increase the speed limit. And the reason you increase the speed limit, the reason that's the right thing to do, is because the most dangerous thing that you have on a highway is differential in speed. If someone's going 70 and someone's going 40, there's going to be a crash. Like, that doesn't work. But when we get to a local street, when we get to something that we would build here in Lake County, the conversation is very different. We go out and do a speed study. Is there speeding? If the answer is yes, then we have to recognize that we're sending the wrong signal to drivers. We have to actually redesign that particular street to send the right set of signals to the driver. At Strong Towns, we have a saying, if you need a sign to tell people to slow down, you design the street wrong. How would we turn this street into a slower street? Well, it's actually the opposite of forgiving design. Instead of widening the lanes, you narrow the lanes. Instead of creating a recovery area, you remove the recovery area. Instead of removing all the trees, you bring the trees in. You tighten things up. When you tighten things up, people respond to that tightness by slowing down. And so if we go back to where we started this with the money question, when we over-engineer and over-design and overbuild, we're actually spending a lot of money to make things considerably less safe. And as we have talked about numerous times throughout the year, we're actually, when we make them considerably less safe, also make them considerably less financially productive. People don't want to build in those locations as much as they want to build on a good street. I think this is where I'm ending. I kind of, my whole presentation got destroyed before I started, so I repatched it together, but I think this is the last idea. If not, I'll end up here and we'll chat. I know many of you, I know some of you have heard of the idea of a complete street. It is, I won't even say like the latest trend, because it's a 20-year-old thing now. It's not the latest, but it is become kind of just broadly adopted and accepted by engineering departments in state government, in county government, across Florida, and really across the entire United States. And this is a response to the idea that a street is really not safe if you have bikes that have to share space with people walking, they have to share space with people driving. And so complete streets, it's a very American kind of mindset here, is that everybody will get their place, right? Everybody will get their own kind of space in the public realm. I call this the Oprah approach, right? Like, you get a lane, you get a lane, you get a lane. You're driving a car, you get a lane. You're driving a bus, you get a lane. You're on a bike, you get a lane. People walking, you get a lane. Everybody gets something. When I was a young engineer, and this concept was being introduced, I watched my fellow engineers, and I will not exempt myself from this, have a little bit of bemusement and bewilderment about this. It seemed kind of silly because, you know, in our mindset, we were trying to move cars very quickly. Why would we do all this other stuff? I've watched the engineering profession change their mind about complete streets in the last couple decades. And the primary reason is because complete streets comes with a lot more resources. Remember, the number one problem we're trying to solve from a transportation standpoint is how to get more money. It's not how to move vehicles, how to deal with congestion. The number one problem, if you go to any public works department, you go to any state DOT, the number one problem that they're dealing with is not traffic and traffic flow and all that, it is resources. Where do we get the money to do stuff? That's the number one problem they're trying to solve. And complete streets comes with more money. And so I've watched the profession kind of adapt to it. The other thing that's very interesting about complete streets is that complete streets requires no compromise in the engineering ethics. It allows us to over-engineer, over-design, and overbuild our roadways, our local streets, as if they were highways. As we say at Strong Towns, complete streets accommodate pedestrians in an auto-dominated environment. A Strong Towns approach, and this is approach, you know, if we go to a city like Groveland, we go to a city like Claremont, we go to a city that is trying to become a place, a great place, a financially productive place, a very successful place, is one where the design is around people. When we build great streets, we see people show up, we see people build homes, live in homes, shop in businesses, fall in love, invent things, make music, do all kinds of wonderful things. When we build roadways, we move cars very quickly. Roadways are really, really important, and we need them to connect our places. But when we get into a place, we really have to focus on how do we make that place as successful as we can. And when we do that primarily through traffic engineering, what we end up with is places that are really good at moving cars and not very good at other things. And we really need desperately those other things. So yeah, let me stop there. Let's talk transportation. Let's talk Lake County. Let's talk about anything that you all want to talk about here. So please, go ahead.
So basically, if we don't build more roads or widen or all that, we're asking drivers to drive slower. And if it takes more time to get to work, they're going to tend to work closer, or take a bus, or ride a bike. Is that the whole thing?
I feel like you are like 99% there. Yes. Can I say it a little bit differently?
Yes,
let me put it like this. You have lots of congestion. Let's just posit that. Every city in the country, every county in the country, every community has congestion. How do we respond to congestion? What are the multiple ways we can respond to congestion? Well, one is we go build more stuff. And what we see is that, you know, even if we didn't have the constraint, financial constraint that we have, which we have a massive financial constraint here in Lake County, even if we didn't have that, building more stuff really never solves congestion. So that's option number one, is to do something that we don't have the money to do and doesn't work. But that's actually our default plan, right? Option number two would be drivers adjust. It's very interesting when we look at work from home. Since the pandemic, there have been a lot of people who now have hybrid work, work from home. It's not everybody. A lot of people who earn wages don't have this option. A lot of people who are professionals do, so there's a little bit of a class thing there too as well. But the interesting thing about work from home is that when we look at the traffic models over time, it's taken the peak off. Because someone who works from home that's got to go in for a meeting will go in a little bit later or a little bit earlier. They're able to flex their schedule. Or they're working from home, they got to make a run to the grocery store. They're not going to do it during rush hour, they're going to do it after that. So what it's done is it has, traditionally you saw this peak during rush hour and then this drop, and then another peak in the evening rush and drop. What has happened is that peak is less high, it's lower, and in the off periods, it's higher. So people have adjusted their patterns and balanced things out. That's another option. Here is a third option, and it's the one that is rarely discussed, but you hit on it, and I'm very proud of you for doing this because it usually is on nobody's mind. We have to build things closer to where we live. We actually have to give people options that are closer to where they live. So if you think about going to get a gallon of milk, if your option for getting a gallon of milk is 10 miles away on a congested roadway, and it will take you 40 minutes, there is a market for you to have someone have milk that would be a 5-minute walk away from you. If our zoning codes, our ordinances, our building procedures, our processes don't allow the market to respond by building that building that would sell you milk, what we are doing is we are forcing everyone onto the roadway. And so we can respond dynamically by building more transportation. We actually don't have the money to do that. Or we can respond dynamically by allowing more things to happen in the private marketplace. Here's the cool thing about that. We can grow our tax base, we can have investment, we can actually have a lot of opportunity for people that's kind of off the sidelines today. So did I answer you? I feel like we're on the same page, and I feel like you said it, I just wanted to say it in a different way. Okay. Are we good?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you. That was very, that is an insight that you got in like 30 seconds that actually took me a decade and a half to figure out. So, please.
Here in Lake County, we have an awful lot of flag waving, freedom and liberty types, the far right wing that would say that this is restricting their freedom to go where they want to go and when they want to go.
Yeah.
How do you answer that?
Well, I might join them in a lot of ways, right? Like, I'm former military, I'm a flag-waving guy. I grew up in a small town on a farm. I think one of the great things about America and our transportation system is that we do have the freedom to go where we want, when we want, absolutely. I think recognizing, though, that the system is not, in a sense, pay-as-you-go. Transportation is the ultimate communist, socialist endeavor, right? Like the government provides the system. You know, as soon as you recognize that, it kind of changes the economics in a way. In this country, I showed you at the very beginning how to pay for the roadways, just the maintenance of the federal roadway, we need a 78 cent federal gas tax. If you look at the state and the local level, you know, you're doubling that. If people paid for the roadways that they use, I think that the argument that having other options available for people to like shop locally or what have you would be less critical. But I also think if people paid directly for what they used, there would be like hardly any demand. The interesting thing about the American development pattern is if you look at cities before the Interstate Highway Act, we humans, Americans, you know, and I my grandfather fought in World War II. I mean, I have a lot of respect for this generation, you know, that grew up during the Depression and all that. When you look at the cities that they built before the Interstate Highway Act, they had automobiles. They built cities kind of the way that they've always built cities. They fit cars in them, right? They didn't go out and build interchanges and build all this stuff. Ultimately, when you could get the federal government to pay for something for you, they began to, I think, like normal humans, consume more of it than they were willing to pay for themselves. And you've seen decade after decade after decade after decade of that kind of government largesse providing this opportunity for all of us to enjoy 5 times, 10 times the amount of transportation infrastructure than we are, in fact, willing to pay for. And so while I'm, you know, a flag waving, like I like to go where I want, whenever I want, I also want government to run prudently. I also want government to live within its means. I also don't want it to pander to every little interest, every little thing, go out and build as much transportation infrastructure as, you know, the rabble would demand just because they demand it. I want government to like balance the books and be prudent and understand what they're doing. I also think it's very illustrative. If you look at the history of roadway funding, highway funding at the federal level, we tend to, well, all of us remember 2008, right? What came out of 2008? And I, again, I'm not picking on Barack Obama. It just happened, he just happened to be there. 2008 was the great financial crash. Right away, we started shovel-ready projects. Remember that term, shovel-ready projects? What was a shovel-ready project? Yeah, it was a crappy project that had been fully designed and that no one was willing to fund or pay for that we put on a shelf. And when we got into economic hardship, we took all those crappy projects off the shelf and went and did them at scale. That was our solution. Economists, and believe me, our country is run by economists. That is the, you know, if we have one national religion, it is economics and really post-war kind of Keynesian version of economics. Every time we run into financial difficulty, we get the showering of infrastructure money from the federal government, from the state government. It generally funds the worst projects. It generally funds projects that are the worst in terms of like local viability. You see this with the most recent Biden infrastructure bill. And so I think it's important for us to recognize that we consume and we ask for many, many, many more multiples of transportation funding than we are ever willing to pay for. And until we resolve that at the federal level, the only way to safeguard ourselves at the local level is to be really, really prudent about our measuring our long-term liabilities whenever we're making an investment. So we know what we're doing, and then, you know, allow the free market to respond, not just by driving to the next place, but by actually building the next place in a location that makes sense for people. Does that make sense?
Yeah, can
yeah, please, go ahead.
A little bit further.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm specifically wondering about, and I like everything that you've said. It all
you don't have to,
but it all makes perfect sense.
Sure.
I'm old enough to remember downtown.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And the main drag.
Yeah, yeah.
And people walking in window shopping.
Right.
I'm old enough to remember it and appreciate it.
Yeah.
This whole thing about what I've heard referred to as road crowding.
Sure.
With bike lanes and with pedestrian safety measures,
yeah,
and things like that.
Yeah.
And this idea of reversing the forgiving design to slow people down.
Yeah.
That is what they really, really object to.
Yeah.
And I find myself at a lack of trying to challenge,
yeah,
their ideas.
Yeah. And so let's talk about that part, because I think that part is really very interesting and subtle. If you are on a roadway, if we're trying to get from here to Orlando, you want roads the whole way. You want forgiving design. You want gradual merging. But you don't want a Home Depot, a Costco, a Target, a gas station. You don't want that. Because what that stuff does is that stuff slows you down. It artificially creates congestion. What you're looking at when you see that stuff is you're looking at Well, let me say it in the crassest term. You're looking at land speculators who are leveraging the public investment for their own short-term gain. So that's not free market economics. That's like land speculation. That's gambling of the public purse. We've always had that. When we built the St. Lawrence Seaway, you know, St. Lawrence, like the canals, like you had all that. This goes along with the infrastructure, right? If you know the right people in government and can get out in front and buy the land where the interchange will be, you will make a lot of money. There's an art to that. Okay. So what you want going from here to Orlando is a roadway without encumbrances. And every time you see encumbrances, it is generally of the type where there's speculators making a buck. When you get into a place, though, and let's say a city, an urban area, what you want is really two things. You want the tax base to be sufficient to actually take care of all the stuff that you're committed to do. If it requires you to build a pipe, you actually want enough tax base to maintain that pipe. If you have to build a water tower or a treatment plant, you want enough connections, enough people in this area to have that payoff. You want your place to be financially viable. As a driver, though, what you also want is you want to be able to get to your destination in a short amount of time. Here's the rub, and this is so hard. When you widen up lanes, when you add recovery area and clear zone, what you make happen is that drivers can drive faster. But because they're driving faster, they can't merge in with each other. They have to flow. And so what you have to do is you have to add traffic signals. You have to add street lights. You've got to red, yellow, green. You've got to stop people. And when you stop people, you go 0 miles an hour. If you look at the typical speed that someone travels when they're traveling in that type of environment, an environment where you have to have traffic signals, it drops way down. You basically go 30 miles an hour, then zero. 30 miles an hour, zero. 30 miles an hour, zero. And what you end up with is an average speed of somewhere around 10, 11, 12 miles an hour. So, if you tighten up the lanes and you slow things down, and you have people drive, say, 15 miles an hour, maybe 20 miles an hour, what you find is that you can actually merge in and out of that traffic stream really well. You won't have the over-engineered roundabouts you have here today. You'd have smaller traffic circles. Things would just flow. And people get to where they're going much more quickly. And so what we do today is we pay for over-engineered streets that reduce our tax base, cost a ton, are really not safe, and cause us to get to our destination with greater travel time. If we actually narrowed up our streets, we would have less cost, we'd have a safer design, we would have more people want to build and invest there, and you would get to where you're going more quickly. That's the crazy part.
With a lower blood pressure.
Well, some people get really mad when they can't drive fast, and I see that in people. Communities that are built this way, I don't know the local vibe around here about a place like Celebration. I know there's some, you know, weirdness because it's a Disney place and what have you. Okay, I don't care about any of that. Go there and drive some of their streets, especially the part in the core downtown. If you really focus on your own blood pressure, your own drive, I think you will find that you are not sensitive to the low speeds. You actually will not feel this tension to drive fast because the streets are actually engineered to not do that. Where you feel the tension to drive fast is when the street is over-engineered and artificially slowed down. Because then you're getting two different signals. The one signal is drive very fast, because it's over-engineered to drive fast. And the other signal is I can't drive fast because there's someone slowing me down. What we want to do is have the design correspond to the human reaction and emotion correspond to how people then drive. Does this make sense? Okay, is that good? Like, this guy's like the most brilliant urban designer I've ever met. So I'm saying things that you're actually the expert on, but I'm in bounds on all this, right? I'm just a lowly engineer.
You went to school.
I did. Please, someone back there had something.
Yes. I was just wondering if anybody thought about specific lanes for just trucks. I know in different states they have lanes that trucks have to stay in.
Yeah.
And cars stay in the other lanes.
Yes. I think when you're talking about highways, there's a really good case for that. And I've seen it done, and I've seen, especially if you go overseas, you see it sometimes. I've seen that work very effectively, because big trucks have their own kind of dynamics to them, almost like a railroad, right? If you can line them up, it makes a lot of sense. I think the problem we have on local streets is that on local streets, we tend to design for the largest vehicle. Again, I think the engineering profession likes to, I'm going to say this, and this is going to sound more nefarious than it is, but looks for every reason to expand. Remember I said there's, from the used driver experience, there's very little downside to over-designing. So they tend to look for every reason to over-engineer. And one of the reasons that's often used is we have to accommodate semi-tractor trailers. We have to accommodate the massive fire truck. We have to accommodate the garbage truck at speed, you know, all these things. The reality is that all of these things come in very different sizes. Let me use an extreme example. And I'm not suggesting that this is anything like what you experience here, but I'm going to give you an extreme example. If any of you have been fortunate enough to go to Venice, you will recognize in Venice that there are no cars. There are boats. And if you get off a boat and walk the streets are often this narrow, like literally like the width of you. How do they have restaurants with food? How do they have shops with stuff? How do they get rid of their garbage? How do they do any of this stuff? They do it with very small carts. They do it with very small cars or you know, vehicles. They lug things around. Now, Venice is an extremely wealthy place. You can actually, it actually pays for someone to haul your food in on their back. But if we go to just like a normal place, the idea that you would have drop-offs on the edge of town with large trucks, where then a small truck would actually deliver things locally, that is very, very, very common outside of North America. In fact, that I think is the default outside of North America, because only in North America do we consider it like good design to have a semi-tractor trailer be able to go right down Main Street and pull up to a business. Yeah. Anybody else? Please, go ahead.
Yeah, I've attended quite a few presentations in cities in the county where they're talking about expanding the width of a highway. Department of Transportation will have presentations on it. And what really kind of perturbs me from a taxpayer standpoint is that all these groups have lobbied into the standards so that when you do like a mile of widening on a state highway, you gotta have a bike path. You gotta have turnout lanes. You've got to have a wide right of way. And nobody seems in this state, compared to where I came from, where whenever they, you know, platted land and put in space for roads, planted, they would make sure that there was right-of-way there for high future traffic. But here, they don't own the right-of-way, so that doubles the cost per mile for them to just build a mile of widened highway. And that's why we have things like Highway 19 that is still one lane each way in areas, because no one ever, they've got all these standards now for, we gotta have a sidewalk, and then we gotta have a walkway for a path, for golf carts, et cetera, et cetera. And so you end up having this real wide cross section. And if you look at the design cross sections, you'll see that it's like the road is maybe one third of the total width of the area. And then they got all these standards that really build up the cost. And so that's one reason, in my view, that you see any solutions for that. Seems like narrowing roads and eliminating all the extras on the side would be one step.
Well, in general, Lake County, like I said, you are the next place where the sun is shining. And when we get into those kind of places where the sun is all of a sudden shining, there is this tendency to say, we're not going to make the mistakes that the last place the sun was shining on made. And so if they're struggling with right away, we're going to get that right away. If they're struggling with street width, we're going to over widen here. And what we see is that as we go out further from Orlando, as we go up further from Minneapolis and my own town, you know, state, whatever, the further you get out, the more, I think, kind of extreme the whole delivery process becomes. And so you get, in a sense, a magnification of the worst habits the further out you get. I think there's a lack of understanding and a lack of humility. The kind of assumption is that the people who did that one and screwed it up were dumb, were very smart. And you tend to overcompensate for their mistakes. And so, you know, to me, I feel like the whole premise of if you haven't picked this up yet, let me just say this in very clear language. I think the whole premise of our transportation system is faulty. And your state, your county, your cities are kind of trapped in this faulty premise. And so they do things that are very illogical from anyone who's not in that trap. If we can step outside of it, and if we start with the idea that we don't have the money, like the money is actually a constraint, because the money is a constraint, they treat it as if it's no constraint. If we actually start with the idea that we don't have enough money to do this, it's a constraint, then we have to ask all kinds of other questions that get us out of that paradigm. But until we do that, the craziness that you described will be the way that they approach it. Because if money's no obstacle, then why be constrained by anything? And money is no obstacle. I mean, we approach these things as if money is no obstacle. That's the reality. How are we doing on time? I have to say that I'm feeling a little queasy. I've been ill for a couple days, and not like ill, like contagious ill, but just like too much travel, and the room started to spin a little bit. So I think what I'm gonna do is sit down. If you wanna chat with me, I will sit up here and we can talk. You wanna finish up?
Yeah.
Thanks, Frank.
So, from Strong Towns, we really wanna thank Lake County. We wanna thank the County Commission. We want to thank the communities that have sent their staff and dedicated time. Your action team, the 26 members of this community, got on the phone every 2 weeks. They did homework assignments, they read things, they shared things. They were dedicated to shifting the conversation here in Lake County. So we really want to thank folks for doing that. If you want to see these slides, if you want more information about what we're talking about tonight, if you go to strongtowns.org/lake-county, so strongtowns.org/lake-county, it'll take you right to a landing page and you can get all of this information. You can sign up, give us your email, we will communicate with you, share these ideas we've been communicating throughout your community. If you have additional questions and you didn't get it tonight, or tomorrow morning you wake up, or next week you talk to your neighbor, you can email me as well, edward@strongtowns.org, or you can call us. My cards are in the back. We want to continue this conversation in Lake County. And there's an opportunity for us to talk to folks in the community, to walk through this in more depth. We're happy to do that. That's part of our process over this next year. Tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock, we're going to be meeting back here. We're going to be talking about affordable housing. If you have an interest in that, you are more than welcome to attend that session. There'll be a lot of technical staff from across the county that will be participating. But again, go to our website, strongtowns.org/lake-county. There's a lot of information there. There's over 10 sessions in there. We've highlighted some incredible things happening here in Lake County. And if there's other incredible things that we need to hear about, please let us know. We'd love to share that. But thank you, everybody, for your time this evening.
Thank you.